It is my pleasure to be here with you today at the 27th Annual CIBC Western Institutional Investor Conference. Next up, I would like to introduce Eric Greager, President and CEO over at Baytex Energy. We will have time throughout this fireside chat for audience-initiated Q&A, and would encourage you to raise your hand kind of throughout the presentation. First off, thank you for joining us, and I think you have a couple words that you'd like to say prior to.
So real pleased to be here, Dennis. Thank you. Beautiful place. Appreciate the interest in the story. Baytex Energy, you may or may not know, in 2023, we executed a transformational transaction, including, increasing our exposure to U.S. Gulf Coast MEH pricing. I'll speak a little bit about that transaction in these prepared remarks, but also throughout the Q&A, happy to expand on that. We're now one full published quarter beyond the closing. We closed on June 20th. Q3 is in the books, a very strong quarter across all three important pillars to our business. Our heavy oil business continues to demonstrate lots of strength. Three discoveries in 3 years, three land extensions across the fairway, and lots of strength. Our Eagle Ford business, importantly, our operated business, continues to perform above our expectations. Q3 results were very strong, and our Duvernay business, again in Q3, we delivered the six wells, two three-well pads, design of experiment that we had been promising through 2023, really unlocking the potential of the Pembina Duvernay, and we're very excited that that is, in fact, the growth engine over our five-year plan. Our five-year plan, published just a few months ago, has us moving from 153,000 BOE a day to, as an annualized average for 2023, to 170,000 BOE a day. Over that same five-year planning period, we'll pay down our debt to about half a turn of leverage at today's prices, a full turn at $50, a very defensive paydown of our debt. We can talk a little bit more about how that debt is termed out, should that be interesting to the audience. And then, obviously, the return of capital framework. We take our free cash flow and divide it two ways, 50% of it to debt paydown, 50% of it to shareholders, weighted heavily toward an NCIB buyback structure with a small fixed-base dividend of a little over 2% yield today.
Great. No, appreciate that introduction and the opening remarks there. I want to maybe go to the first item that you were talking about, obviously a very large transformational Eagle Ford acquisition transaction. How should we be thinking about the integration of those assets, how you think about the capital allocation between kind of north of the border and south of the border, and how that maybe provides a little bit more balance within the organization as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm not sure I can make this thing go forward, and I don't know that I necessarily need it. But the Ranger acquisition was an acquisition by merger, nearly doubled our operating cash flow, increased our production by about 75%. And because you double the operating cash flow against a 75% increase, that of course implies higher realized pricing, and that is in fact one of the objectives. We have a really, really strong non-op asset in the Karnes Trough, and we really wanted to increase our exposure to MEH pricing, so Magellan East Houston pricing along the Gulf Coast, while also building some optionality along the gas window to Gulf Coast natural gas pricing when eventually it'll be worth something. And this has turned out to be very strong. So when you compare the first half of the year to the second half of the year, the first half was Baytex standalone, and the second half as a combined entity, we increased our total output by 75% as measured as total BOE per day, against an increase in capital of 55%. So a 75 for 55 trade, again, doubled our cash flow for a 75% increase in production, and defensive in nature. Had we anticipated the widening of the basis diffs, we might have been smarter than the average, but we didn't, and I don't think many people did. But when basis diffs widen in Western Canada, that certainly impairs Western Canadian returns, And this is part of the defensive nature of the transaction is, of course, on the Gulf Coast, those are still, you know, benchmark pricing above WTI. So that we really like. We also inherited a very strong operating and technical team in Houston. And now we've got 60% of our production, 60% of our capital, and 60% of our cash flow coming out of the Eagle Ford, out of the strong realized pricing environment, and spins off quite a handsome chunk of U.S. denominated free cash flow. And that excess free cash flow is redomiciled or repatriated back to Canada and is used to stand up and reinforce our heavy oil pillar to our strategy and the continued growth engine of our Duvernay. So let me pause there, Dennis.
No, I really appreciate that background and the color there. I think the interesting aspect here, and maybe going to another point that you highlighted in your introduction, was really related around leverage, balance sheet capacity, and the allocation of free cash flow. I wouldn't mind kind of touching a little bit more on that, where you kind of discuss where a comfortable level around leverage happens to be and what that opens up in terms of opportunity set on a go-forward basis.
Yeah. So clearly, you know, the industry in general across North American E&P is much healthier today than it's been in the recent past, and certainly across the last decade. That's a very good thing. We sit on the higher end of the leverage ratio, admittedly, on a total debt to EBITDA or net debt to EBITDA basis. And, you know, that is both a blessing and a curse, right? It depends on where you are in the cycle and how people view risk versus reward. I personally think it's a very, very strong balance sheet. We are committing to debt pay down and will consistently generate, you know, substantial free cash flows and take half of those free cash flows to pay down our debt. So that's a continuing, ongoing basis. But it also happens to be the least expensive pool of capital that any E&P has access to. And if you think that, you know, our businesses are really about generating higher returns at the balance sheet level and lower weighted average cost of capital at the balance sheet level, then net cash balance sheets force you to go to the higher cost of capital, which is equity capital. And so the way we think about it is a healthy balance sheet is very important. Having these things termed out 2030, 2027, and then the balance on a very strong and well-supported revolver is a real strong balance sheet, nicely termed out. Our bonds trade at 103, so there's clearly not stress in terms of the bond trading apparatus and generating very strong cash flows and a strong strategic business plan. But yeah, it does. I think if you see the glass in the world of energy, particularly traditional fossil fuels, as half empty, you may lean toward a much lower leverage ratio, which would effectively drive up, by choice, drive up your weighted average cost of capital. We try to keep those things in mind, but are balanced in terms of how we manage both the current leverage ratio as well as the debt pay down. So if there's more, I'm happy to unpack that a little bit.
No, that's really good context, and I appreciate that color. Obviously, there is a focus, obviously, given your 50-50 allocation between deleveraging and then we'll call it free cash return to shareholders. Mm-hmm. As you proceed forward on that, on the return component to shareholders, at what levels do you feel comfortable pushing up that relative proportion of free cash? And then maybe how does that necessarily manifest itself? You've highlighted the base dividend. You've been active on the share buyback program. Where do you see the most value in terms of that capital allocation structure?
You bet. Thank you. So we have set $1.5 billion total debt in absolute terms as the next milestone in our the next pivot point, if you like, in our free cash flow allocation. So at that point, we'll move from our current 50-50 allocation to a 75-25 allocation, with the 75% leaning toward shareholders. We'll still have a bias toward NCIB. Really like the dollar cost averaging component of an NCIB. And we also really like the idea of having this fixed-based dividend that gets rebased over time. And so the idea that, you know, in any given period of time, any given 12-month NCIB approval, We'll take out up to 10% of our total float. And in fact, in the second half of last year, we took out almost 5% of our total outstanding shares, not just the float, but the total outstanding shares. And if you think about, you know, that for a moment, what it allows you to do is you take out the shares, which lowers the absolute leakage toward your dividend. And then each year as you approach the end of your NCIB, you count up the number of shares you've taken out. You can rebase your fixed base dividend up to the total quantum you would have paid. And that creates a systematic rebasing approach to the degree to which you take out shares 10% of your float, you can rebase your fixed base dividend 10% per year without increasing the absolute leakage to your business. And we like that approach because it's modest to begin with. It's very predictable. The mechanism allows for, you know, formulaic rebasing, a systematic approach to the increase in the fixed base yield. And we like that approach because, you know, investors in the business can understand and anticipate when things are going to happen. And you tend to see a higher likelihood of being paid for those as opposed to other forms of returns like esoteric variable structures or worse, one-time specials, which are really hard to predict. Mm-hmm. So we like this approach. And in the five-year time frame, as predicted in our presentation, we'll get to the $1.5 billion and get to this pivot point. So over that five-year plan, just at $75 flat, we return almost $3 billion to our shareholders through the current transaction and current business.
Fantastic. No, I appreciate that incremental color as well. You touched on it a little bit there in terms of, I guess, opportunity set for investment in terms of your portfolio. When we think about, we'll call it production growth on a go-forward basis, there is some degree of that through your five-year plan. How do you think about balancing reinvestment and kind of, again, showing organic production growth versus then maybe an inorganic opportunity set that exists outside of your company?
You bet. Great question. So in the last four quarters of the year, we've actually, that includes the Ranger transaction, but also goes far enough back to be undisturbed. And so across the past four quarters, we've actually grown our production per share by 20%. So 20% per year in the last year. In that same period of time, we've also compressed our cash cost structure and improved our cash flow per share by more than 30%, again, in the past four quarters, from the before times undisturbed to the after times fully released. And so that feels really good. We actually like the idea of continuing to grow this base business as it stands today at notionally about 2% per year at the headline, this production growth on an organic top line basis. Meanwhile, taking out up to 10% of our float through the NCIB, that's a share removal. So if you think production per share, that really supports growth. And then you add to that total shareholder return another 2+% base dividend yield. You're getting in around 10% total shareholder return, probably a little north of that. And you're also improving the business turn by turn along the way without really needing higher prices. Even today, this business at today's prices spends off, you know, over $500 million of free cash flow just at today's kind of support level pricing. So we feel really good about the base business and really good about the five-year plan. We also think when you can set your base business up to not have to do anything, right? You run a very good base business. It grows over time, growing, you know, fixed base dividend yield, growing top line production growth, and growing production per share. That sets you up to be opportunistic. And we've got two basins to play in. We really like the Eagle Ford, as evidenced by our comments and our actions in the last 12 months. But we also really love the Western Canadian Sedimentary Basin. So Western Canada has a lot of tailwind today. Coastal GasLink and LNG Canada are going to be a game changer for the gassier producers. TMX, as we've all been anxiously awaiting this week, we now have a nice tailwind. And that's going to be meaningful for everyone, including Baytex. And so, you know, I think there are opportunities for us to focus around our growth engine within our three-legged stool and our portfolio, which is our growth in the Pembina Duvernay, because I think we've cracked the code there and we have systematic math and physics engines that can continue to unlock that. But we also think there are opportunities to pair up and create over the long arc of time bigger, more liquid, better capitalized, and more relevant North American companies that have lower access to lower cost of capital, investment-grade credit, and higher returns through a high-graded portfolio. So we think, you know, the whole thing gets better over time, provided you can systematically create, turn by turn, a bigger, but more importantly, better company over time. So.
No, appreciate, like, that was really good context there.
Thank you.
I think one of the ideas that you mentioned in there is ensuring that a well-run business isn't forced into making any kind of incremental acquisitions. I think a lot of the investor focus more recently is either some combination of balance sheet, which we've already addressed, but I think also incrementally inventory.
Yeah.
So can you talk to a little bit around what you've been able to accomplish, both in terms of your own delineation, kind of smaller little projects, Morinville, Mannville, within kind of Saskatchewan, and how that all kind of brings together that longer runway of inventory and allows you to start with a solid base business?
You bet. So broadly across the portfolio, we've got more than 10 years of inventory, you know, based on this kind of headline 2% per year growth, more than 10 years across the entire inventory stack. More importantly, we've got 12 to 15 years in our operated Eagle Ford and our non-op as well, as a sidecar to that. And then really importantly in the Duvernay, we've got 20 to 25 years of inventory. So you can see why I want to make that a growth engine. Returns are strong. We've got a differentiated and competitive advantage there with regard to our demonstration phase and the results of that. But you know, one of the things I couldn't be more excited about is the heavy oil fairway. We have a very good heavy oil team. We have two geoscience teams that are out exploring all the time. We have petrophysical understanding that is unique. It's one of the things that allowed us to be a first mover in Peavine and create just a spectacular opportunity in anyone's portfolio. And you know, if you start with Peavine 3 years ago and then you add the Rex discovery at Morinville, just north of Edmonton, and the strong realized pricing that will result in, and then you add to that the Waseca discovery up in Cold Lake, and then you add the land extensions both to in and around Ardmore and our Cold Lake, Waseca and Mannville stack. You add to that our extension to the northeast of our Peavine position and what we think that means in terms of its discovery and potential around the Falher, the Bluesky, and of course the Clearwater. And then you add to that, which we've only just begun to talk about, which is a northwest Peace River Bluesky extension called the Grizzly, which we believe in as well. And so three land extensions, three discoveries. The team is out there all the time. We fund a small but consistent exploration plan, and they've experienced lots of success. So two teams, 3 years of success, land extensions around that success. And you pay almost nothing for this, right? It's the intellectual property the team created. It's the efforts of the exploration program. But you pay almost nothing because these are first mover advantages around plays that others haven't seen. And none of them are a company maker in and of themselves, but each one will generate a couple hundred million dollars of NAV accretion of the business, basically out of thin air. And you put three together, and that's $1 billion already, and it's certainly embedded as upside because it's not in the value of our company.
No.
So lots of potential, lots of strength around that part of the pillar. And the three parts of the pillar with different price points, crude slate, and access to different parts of the North American egress market, we think create a real stable platform over time, as evidenced by our five-year plan.
Oh, fantastic. Let's dig into maybe one of the really strong success stories in what you just outlined in Peavine. Obviously, extraordinarily strong results from that region, pushing kind of the bounds of 15,000 plus barrels a day.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit around what that asset could look like? What, I don't want to say there is going to be incremental growth, but wanted to maybe characterize what that looks like kind of over the next
There certainly
while.
Has been, you know, because when you and I first met a year and a half or so ago, I began talking about 12 to 15, and I think one of the questions was, well, it could do more. Why 12 to 15? And the answer was, we're very respectful of the Peavine Métis. We're very respectful of the relationships we've built. And like any good relationship, you have to invest. You have to do what you say you're going to do, and you have to be worthy of trust. And the reason we've been able to push the top end of that 12 to 15, and in fact in Q3 go above 15, and we think sustainably stay above, you know, 15 and in that kind of 15 to 16 range, is because our southern extension, the most recent wells we released, We're an extension just to the south of our core, and those wells have surprised to the upside. Initial production rates stronger than we expected. Reservoir quality, viscosity, mobility, just general quality plus pressure, all better than we expected. And so surprising to the upside and creating stronger results, which allows us to move to the above the midpoint and stay at the high end without investing any more capital and without overrunning our headlights in the community, because it's just the same physical development we planned, just outperformance in the subsurface. So we anticipate more of that, because the implication is that it has broadened the geographic extent of the quality reservoir above what we thought. We thought, we pretty sure we ring-fenced all the stuff we wanted. Pretty sure many of our peers have de-risked the edges and haven't seen the kind of results we've seen. But it is better than we expected within our extensions to the core, which make the whole thing a lot more valuable. Mm-hmm. And the P-Vine will print well over $1 billion of free cash in the next decade on its own. One tiny little green-headed prairie chicken in our deck will generate more than $1 billion of free cash, because it long since paid its acquisition value and it long since paid its development capital. So really, really exceptional. And you know, the Clearwater's quite a play in Western Canada anyway, and we represent more than 10% of the total production and hold 30 of the top 30 wells mm-hmm. in the play. So I think it's a testimony, one, to the quality of the Clearwater, the quality of the Peavine, and the quality of the team that discovered it and ring-fenced it. Mm-hmm.
No, fantastic. I wanted to maybe dig into a potentially upcoming success story. Obviously, you have a long track record and history around drilling in the blue sky, and multilateral drilling has kind of come a lot more in vogue, especially with the development in the Clearwater, but you do have a long history and a lot of experience with that. Can you talk about how you're able to maybe leverage that expertise into developments in Lloydminster, as well as maybe additional development in the blue sky, as you just mentioned?
Yeah. So oftentimes when I talk about the conventional cold flow heavy fairway, I'm referring to the Clearwater. It goes by many names: Broader Spirit River, the Rex, but also the Manville Stack, which is a stack of horizons, not just the Waseca, which we've spoken about in particular around Cold Lake, but also the GP, the Sparky. It's a stacked environment, and many of these are of very high quality. And so sometimes you go after one and you realize, as you begin to delineate and de-risk through stratigraphic testing and pilot work, that there's something you didn't expect. Right, two-way, three-way structures you didn't see. You can take advantage of trapping arrangements. And so we've really only deployed our new petrophysical understanding, and it's unique. It's not something that is obvious unless you've taken the time to do a new interpretation of the core to log correlations, which we've done in discovery of these new clays. But the entire Manville Stack, multiple horizons, the Clearwater across its prospectivity, really does represent a huge future opportunity. We think it's a steady diet. We think over the course of time we'll continue to make real geologic discoveries where the rock is better than, you know, maybe folks understood. And we also think we'll be able to act on that intelligence while it's fresh and while it's unique to us to make fresh land extensions before the prices move. And so that's been the game plan so far. And three discoveries later and three land extensions later, it's a pretty steady diet. So real proud of the team. And with a tailwind of WCS narrowing, I think that's gonna be real profitable.
Fantastic. I think we've talked a lot about how you've built, frankly, a solid foundation around the context of the business. In your experience prior to you joining Baytex, you had also a very successful opportunity set in kind of rolling up and consolidating a lot of properties and companies within another basin. How does that maybe shift or allow you to think about your corporate strategy now that you're here at Baytex and with that exposure both north and south of the border? And maybe what are the end goals here for the company?
Yeah, I think the world is a different place today than it was even a few years ago. You know, there are bigger and bigger companies consolidating North America. It's a cost of capital story because clearly money now costs something. Capital now costs something it didn't a few years ago. That drives people to do certain things and companies to do certain things. But also the industry framework itself is changing, and those who buy our issuance, right, our bonds and our stock, they're also changing. The structure of the buy side universe is changing. Larger firms are consolidating, they're becoming bigger books, they can concentrate more, but they need liquidity in and out of their issuers, right? They need to be able to invest in larger, more liquid institutions. And so it's a bit of an arms race, if you like, and I mean that in a positive context, not a negative one. As the investors get bigger pools of capital, they look for larger institutions to invest in. And if you think about the base of this pyramid, the bottom needs to narrow because there are too many issuers for too few investors. And essentially what that means is if there are too many homes that look exactly the same on the block and there are too few buyers, then the value of the homes goes down relative, right? It's a reverse auction. And I think the industry framework is a lot the same way, and I think this is the future. And so middle market E&Ps live in a unique place where we can't really grow fast without blowing up capital budgets because our base is so big, right? So we're at 155,000 BOE a day. If we wanted to lean in and grow at 10% per year, that would not gain support. So you have to grow modestly top line while maintaining good capital efficiency and the like and doing all the other things we've discussed. But you also eventually have to compress the base of this pyramid because essentially you've got to create some differentiation, larger issuers who have, you know, the larger, more liquid institutions, better capitalized, access to lower cost of capital, investment grade credit, longer, stickier access to shareholders and the like. And I think that's the long game, but you can't do it without creating value in every turn. And so it's messy because equity is traded daily and it moves on an underlying cycle that is also highly volatile. But over time, the small and mid-cap space has to consolidate. It has to consolidate. And there have to be people who are willing to do the hard work on the issuer side and be the parents in those transactions and those who are willing to sell into that. And it's not going to be easy. It's hard work. But I have done it and created a great deal of value over that four-year period, 100% total shareholder return over the four-year period, which is the highest shareholder return over that period of all the companies listed on RBC Richardson Barr when we started that campaign. So there's a way to do it, and it's hard work, but it can be done.
Fantastic.
And someone has to do it.
Yeah. Fantastic. And with that, we've actually run out of time. So appreciate the time and the conversation, and best of luck with the rest
Great.
Of the meetings.